Group meeting, Sunday, 22nd May, 1988. We have come now practically to the end of the chapter on the teachers of the Upanishads. There is one Upanishad which is of considerable importance. That is the Katha Upanishad. The word Katha means a story or tale. It's the story of a young boy called Nachiketas. And the name Nachiketas means unknowing. His father, a Brahmin, Vajashravasa, was giving away all his possessions before becoming a wandering mendicant. And the boy was looking on at this process. And looking on, he became full of faith, Shraddha. That means a religious fervor too. So he asked his father, "To whom will you give me?" And the father didn't reply. He asked him a second time and a third time. And the father was a little bit annoyed and said, "To death I will give you." So Nachiketas, like the obedient son of a Brahmin teacher, went to the house of death. It happened that Yamaraja, the lord of death, was absent, and he was away for 3 days and nights. When he came back, he found this boy waiting for him. Now this was an offense on the part of the Lord of Death to keep a Brahmin boy waiting. So he apologized and said, "Since I have kept you waiting for 3 days and nights, you can have any three boons which you desire." And the boy asked as the first boon that his father be happy and not retain any feeling against him. That boon was granted. And the second boon was, which he asked for, was to explain the ritual fire and how it was all built up and so on. And the Lord of Death did that. Then came the third boon. The boy said, "After death, some say he exists. Others say he exists not. What is the truth about this?" And the Lord of Death was rather perturbed. He tried to put off the boy's question, offered him all sorts of, well, one may call them bribes, offered him the wealth of the world, of the world and so on, and happiness, and in terms of worldly happiness. And the boy said, "What is the use of wealth and all this in sight of you who sweeps away all of it? Answer my question." And the Lord of Death says to the boy, "You are fit to hear the Supreme Truth." And then he divulges the Supreme Truth, But the way in which he divulges it is such that it is no divulgence to us in ordinary language, ordinary logical language. He expounded the nature of Brahman, or he tried to. Even the Lord of Death can't do that. So now, there is just this page. The originality of the form in which the divine dialogue is presented in the Katha Upanishad throws a revealing light on the nature of such dialogue. Nachiketas goes to the home of the Lord of Death, and he says this doubt about what happens after death. Then Death gives an answer, and Nachiketas realizes Brahman and becomes free from passion and the fear of death. Now, what does it mean to go to the house of death? And what is the meaning of the Lord of Death answering such a question? I feel sure that it means nothing other than the ability to enter into holistic consciousness, to be able to enter into the awareness of truth, of reality, in terms of infinity and eternity. The Lord of Death is he who puts an end to our organic existence, our psychophysical existence. And with the ending of that existence, all attachments and aversions and all detachments to disappear, completely disappear. Attachment to existence, attachment to non-existence, attachment to the desire, the passion to realize the Supreme Truth, to realize Brahman, to fulfill the Atma itself. Now this is what the real meaning of death, the end of all those things which tie one to existence as such. And existence means standing out of the Supreme. But Yamaraja doesn't say that just this. I'm interpreting it all, you see, in this manner. Because I'm sure this is probably the real meaning of death. But this death is not the death, does not refer merely to the death of the organic being. It means the death of, as I said, all attachments, detachments, and aversions, and so forth. So you are then entirely free from existence as such. And in that freedom you find in the Supreme Communion, that state of consciousness which the Buddha called the cessation, which the Upanishadic teachers called the Turiya, the fourth state. You know how they described their earlier states, the waking state, the dreaming state, and the deep sleep state. And they said that in the deep sleep state, one reverts back to the condition of the Atma. But this fourth state transcends all of them. It's in the Mandukya Upanishad that you find some sort of really interesting and instructive information, but it is very difficult to unravel. You have to meditate for years and years before it will yield up its meaning to you. And its meaning for you will be different from its meaning for anybody else, for the very simple reason that each person is utterly unique. He is conditioned in his own way. And so the revelation has to be in a form, in a manner, which is suitable for the unique individual. But it comes not from outside, it is from within your own being. So, in this state of communion, there is the cessation of all discriminative consciousness, worldly consciousness. In Buddhist, in Pali terms, of vijnana, but vijnana in Sanskrit has a somewhat different meaning. It means not just discriminative consciousness, but it means that type of consciousness which is the true knowledge that leads you to the supreme state, the Turiya state. All speech and thought, all particular and limited mental activity is in repose, and there is a suspension of the mortal mode of consciousness, that is our ordinary everyday consciousness. In this enstasy, note carefully, enstasy, not ecstasy, because ecstasy is a being beside yourself. And enstasy is so entering within yourself that the supreme truth is realized. That state of consciousness is quite different from the ecstatic state. Even great mystics who realized this enstatic state had no word in their time to express it. I think enstasy is a modern word. And I'm using that very deliberately. In this enstasy, which is neither a trance nor a state of ecstasy, the Holy One has died to the known world. So Nachiketas going to the home of the Lord of Death does not mean that he was killed or offered up as a human sacrifice to some ritualistic procedure. It is Nachiketas himself who realizes this state. His father, the Brahman Vajashravasa, had not realized it, obviously. Otherwise he would have possibly handed over the teaching to his son. He knows death. That is to say, whilst alive, he knows death. And this is the death that you and I can all bring about through the complete extinction of greed, hate, delusion, fear, suspicion, and all that terrible brood of evil things. And this means, therefore, the complete purification of the psyche, which also needs a pure body. If the body is not pure, there is always a force which hinders the psyche from becoming perfectly pure. Now, he himself is now the Lord of Death. I myself become the Lord of Death. I myself am the Lord of Karma, the Justicia. People talk of the justice of God and so forth as if God were the gentleman upstairs who is having a good time. Nothing of the sort. It is all within human realization. And this is the thing that the conventional presentation of all the religious teachings, they have failed to present this. And if and when some of them knew, they did not present it, because there are serious consequences for the unfit ones to receive such teaching. The most serious consequence is the loss of ordinary everyday morality, social morality, business morality, political morality, and so forth. That gets destroyed if you come to know that early on. You can prevent the destruction of that morality in time if you can be awake. I've mentioned this in my first book, this danger. One's morality is broken. But you have to come out of it, and you can come out of it. I can assure you that. And then it is possible for your particular unique destiny to fulfill itself through your particular unique organism, which is known to the world by your name. Then there is manifest on earth the realization of the immeasurable unknown, the unborn, undying, fearless, sorrowless Atma. Afterwards, the teaching given by the Holy One is the fruit of this communion known as the dialogue with death. Because when that death has been brought about by oneself, then there is a complete transformation of your own consciousness, and you know through yourself, by yourself, from within yourself, not from outside. There is that in Radhakrishnan's translation of the Upanishads, he gives a long introduction in which he tells, gives an account of a disciple who asked his teacher, Bhava, to demonstrate Brahman. And the teacher remained silent. The disciple asked him again, and for a third time. And the teacher said, "I am demonstrating the ultimate reality of Brahman, but you don't see." This silence, this vast emptiness, which is the source of the entire plenitude, that's the extraordinary part of it all. This vast emptiness is that which utterly transforms your consciousness as well as your brain cells. They themselves undergo transformation. This is something which scientists are just beginning to become aware of. There may be those, some of them in Russia and in America. They are becoming aware of this transformation of the brain cells. They change. Because the brain is the link between the transcendent consciousness and the worldly consciousness. We all start with the worldly consciousness because we've got a physical brain of the sort that we do have. But this brain itself has to become transformed if the perfected Holy One is to convey anything about the way, in the Buddha sense of the way, the Magga, or Jesus's way too, and all the great spiritual teachers, in order to demonstrate and to teach the way. But death, the teacher, itself is death, the other life. I have used the double term life, other life throughout this book, but I would prefer now to use life, new life. Because life is eternal. It does not cease. That is something which again has never been properly expounded. It is there in straightforward words in the Chandogya Upanishad when the teacher says, Brahman is prana. Now the word prana means breath. It also means life, eternal. It is the breath of life eternal, really, prana. It is that which lies at the back of all the creative energy through which the manifested universe, all manifestation comes into being. And that, I think, is the real supreme meaning of the word prana, not just energy or life or something like that. So you hold a dialogue with death, which means that you yourself, as you are in your state, communicate, are in relationship with you yourself in that transcendent state of consciousness, which spells the death of all attachments, aversions, detachments, and everything. The death of all manifestation. So you see, death really is the transcendent transformer, transmuter. It's the perfecter of everything. I remember Krishnamurti in Oman saying in one of his talks there, invite sorrow. And then he said, invite death. I never understood what that meant. Now I've begun to see what he meant by all that. This is the meaning of death. But death, the teacher, is death, the new life, consummator and perfecter. If the consummation of what is intended, your destiny, through your organism, then your life so affects the totality that totality pushes out another incarnation, not your incarnation, but another being through whom this unworked out part is supposed to work out or could work out. The presentation of rebirth or reincarnation as the incarnation of a permanent entity, a permanent manifested entity. I completely reject that now. There is no such thing. In this sense, there is a rebirth. You affect the totality, and the totality is constantly affecting you. Insofar as the purpose of your existence for totality and for transcendence is not worked out in your lifetime, then all that effect is stored up in the totality, and totality pushes out another organism to work out its divine will. And that's that, whether you like it or not. Now, give me a minute. So this death, in to use this terminology of some of the great Christian mystics, this is the divine dark, the abyss, which is the firm ground out of which streams all creation by the action of the beyond knowing. The beyond knowing being transcendence itself, that aspect which we as human beings can never know. Even the perfected holy ones can never know anything in anything like the sense in which we use the word knowing, this transcendent reality, this creative activity. How then shall Death Lord answer the question of Nachiketas? Remember, it is Nachiketas' own consciousness, inner consciousness, which is talking to his worldly consciousness. You know, you find all this sort of thing in the Old Testament too. And the angel of the Lord came unto so and so and said this, that and the other. Who is the angel of the Lord? No flapper with golden wings and that sort of nonsense. It's you yourself. It all happens inside you. The whole of religious teaching is the spiritual, the mental spiritual psychology of your inner states of consciousness. That is why all that teaching is put forward in those terms. One or two of them gave out more than the others, but on the whole, hardly anybody has given out much. Krishnamurti in our own day and age has given out a very great deal, but in such language again that it is not easy to grasp, to know just precisely what he is talking of. Perhaps I better not say that. If Krishnamurti had the intellectual genius of a Buddha, he was a Buddha truly in terms of actual being. But if he had the intellectual genius of a Buddha or an Eckhart or somebody like that, maybe he could have expounded things. But that was not in his destiny. I think it was in his destiny to be the right type of speaker for this social age. It is in this age that the social sense has to come to fruition. This is one of the great developments of our own period of life. In the old days it was different. It was hierarchical, it was autocratic, it was this, that and the other. But in our age, Krishnamurti is the one for the social development of all mankind. He is the only one who has been a world teacher, not just a teacher in Magadha or in Palestine or any such place. It's a very significant thing. And as you see, all his teaching is directed towards the unification of man through mankind realizing the true meaning of the word human. I have put it in my terms that the word human really means the blissful creator, which is tantamount to saying man is God. Eckhart said, man verily is God, and God verily is man. He said that in one of his Ascension Day lectures, sermons, entitled Hindrances. You'll find it there. Man verily is God, God verily is man. He was referring, of course, and I expect he had to do that, otherwise the Catholic Church would have done him in. Now, Yamaraja says, even the gods had doubts as to this. Choose another boon instead of the answer to this question. Yama begs him to ask another boon. Nachiketas refuses. But of course, this is the dialogue form as if they were two different people. But it is all within Nachiketas' own inner consciousness itself. Out of the abyss, death, the new life, points his finger to his twin, this life. The organic life. The pointing is the way. Life, the answer, is the invisible unknown, omnipresent. The Lord of Death says, this is not in the Upanishad, this is what I wrote. The Lord of Death says, give me your worldliness. Die to your selfness, says death, and my immortal twin, eternal life, will suffuse you with transcendence here now. This is the supreme yoga. All of you who are interested in yoga and who wish to teach yoga and so forth, do remember this. The Lord of Death says, give me your worldliness, that state of consciousness which is so interested in, self-interested, imprisoned in, tied up with the worldly state as such. The worldly state is a necessary state. It is our hall of learning through which we enter into the truth ultimately. Have to enter into the truth. Give me your worldliness, die to your selfness, and my immortal twin, life, will suffuse you with transcendence. I say this is yoga because you know how yoga is presented in the ordinary way. The eight angas, limbs of yoga. You have yama, which represents the cultivation of the virtues, niyama, the religious practices, then asanas and pranayama, which coupled with yama and niyama, and it won't happen unless they precede asana and pranayama, which entirely purifies the body and leads to pratyahara. Pratyahara is usually translated, and I think this is again a poor translation, to keep away from all sense objects and sense impressions and so forth. No living person can possibly keep away from the sense functions and from the objects of sense, because that is physical existence. Even every yogi, a professional yogi, or self-professed, or a true yogi, has to use his senses. If he doesn't use his senses, there'll be trouble for him as well as for other people unnecessarily. Now, after pranayama, you come to pratyahara. Yes, I'm talking of pratyahara. And pratyahara means freedom from attachment as well as aversion. Those are the two great things from which you have to free yourself. The death of attachment and aversion is the true pratyahara. Then your whole sense life is a pure and a true sense life. So pure and true that your senses become, this I have said dozens of times already, the cords of communion between your ordinary worldly consciousness and your transcendent consciousness. You see, the pratyahara pushes aside, destroys all the obstructions which attachment and aversion bring into our life. Attachment and aversion bring about all the conflict, the confusions, the contradictions, and so on, fears and all the rest of it into our life. So all that is out. This is the real meaning of the yoga. And then comes the dharana, the dhyana, and the samadhi. Dharana comes from dhri, the root is dhri, meaning to uphold. What do you uphold? Not doctrines, dogmas, rituals, and all the rest of the nonsense. You uphold the creative action in eternity of the transcendent reality. That is what you uphold. Then it is that you truly begin to enter into what the Buddha called, and this is where the Buddha's samapattis are so useful. What are the first four called? The... Come on.
Jhanas.
The jhanas, yes. The first four jhanas, and then come the samapattis. The entry into the infinity of akasha, which I simply have called infinity. Akasha has so many meanings. We needn't bother about them now. And then there is the infinity of vijnana, of consciousness. But ordinary vijnana, discriminative consciousness, has no infinity to it at all. This is the transcendent consciousness beginning to operate for the first time. You see, the infinity of vijnana and of infinity of akasha and of vijnana. And then enters into the no thing. What is the meaning of the entry into the no thing, the nothing? It means that all manifestation in consciousness is completely transcended. The Kabbalah emphasizes the importance of that no thing, the Ein Sof, from which proceeds the whole theosophical doctrine of all the different aspects, the tree of life and so on. You get Hesed, good Lord, I've forgotten myself, Bina and Chokmah and Bina, wisdom and intelligence, Hesed and Gevura, and mediating between them, Tiferet and the other Sephiroth, as they are called. So now, dharana, dhyana, and dhyana is meditation. It is at this stage really that one truly meditates. All other meditations are verbal rituals. They have their use, they have their place. They definitely have their use. I shouldn't throw them aside. I shouldn't throw aside any of the conventional religious things, the doctrines, the dogmas, the rituals. They're all useful, they have their place. After all, you can't teach differential calculus to a three-year-old. So there we are, it's like that. Well now, let's go on to the, my goodness, next chapter, chapter 10, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, I'm glad I've spoken all this about death and its significance in terms of the Katha Upanishad, because Krishna, Lord of Yoga, he is called Lord of Yoga, just like Yajnavalkya was called Yogeshwara. Ishvara means the personal deity and of yoga. And so that's what Yogeshwara means to Arjuna. And he says, I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal and imperishable, and of eternal truth, and of pure happiness, bliss, ananda. Now this is a tremendous statement to make. All the Hindu world, generally speaking, correct me if I am wrong, Kishore, believes that Krishna was a particular person and Arjuna was a particular prince, the son of his father Pandu. Now, of course, there may have been a man called Pandu, a ruler, and his sons were five princes. And there was a king called Dhritarashtra, whose son Duryodhana was the wicked one, and the mighty war which takes place, the Mahabharata, as it is called, is like something like Homer's Iliad. Homer's Iliad and Odyssey are some sort of correspondences to the Mahabharata and the Gita and the Odyssey, I should say. Now, I ask, who is Krishna, who Arjuna, and whose gift is the Bhagavad Gita? I personally no longer think that there was this teacher called Krishna as a separate being, different from Arjuna. It's the writer of the Gita who is himself Krishna when he is in the transcendent state of consciousness, which the Hebrews call the I Am state. You know how Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, says to Moses, if the Israelites ask, who hath sent you? Say unto them, Ehiye Asher Ehiye. I, Moses, am Asher, that I am, the transcendent I am. And I think that this knowledge was known to the old sages only. They never divulged it. So the writer of the Gita, and his name was Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa. Krishna, the literal meaning is black or dark colored. Dvaipayana means island born in an island. Veda is knowledge. Veda meaning the supreme knowledge, the transcendent knowledge. Vyasa means compiler. He was the compiler of this transcendent sacred knowledge. The number of things and writings ascribed to Vyasa are so great that he would still be writing if he was an ordinary person alive. I mean, a vast heap of texts are attributed to Vyasa, the compiler. So now, your critic would naturally say to me, you're talking through your hat. Well, how could that be the case? And how could the whole of the Hindu world be deceived as to Krishna not being God incarnate? He is regarded as God incarnate. But I say, look at look at the Gita, Canto 10, verse 37 in the Gita. Look at that. See what Krishna says to Arjuna. He announces, of the children of Vrishni, Vrishni was the name of the clan, I am Krishna. Of the sons of Pandu, I am Arjuna. Among seers in silence, the Munis, the silent ones, they who had realized the supreme truth were the silent ones. They entered that transcendent silence. I am Vyasa. Among poets, I am Ushana, who was one of the Rig Vedic poets before the time of the Mahabharata. Now, how can I, Krishna, belonging to the clan of Vrishni in Western India, also be Arjuna, the other person to whom I'm supposed to be speaking? How can I be Ushana, the poet of the Rig Veda, and so on? I think the writer of the Gita was a perfected holy one who could enter this holistic consciousness. If you can enter the holistic consciousness, space and time have no obstruction whatsoever for you. You know how the Buddha time and again says, even as a strong man can put out his arm or draw it in, in a second. He could go into the realm of the 33 gods or wherever he wanted, or Mount Isigili, or wherever he wanted to go. You see, what on earth does it mean? I mean, his achievement beats all jet planes. And not only he, his great disciples were able to do that. And the perfected holy ones of India have all claimed such powers. You find in the New Testament, time and again, Jesus was not to be seen, not to be found. When the Jews lifted up stones to throw at him, I forget now the exact chapter and verse where it comes, he suddenly was not there. How? What is the meaning of those things? Only the lips kissed by the fire of the immortal can sing a Bhagavad Gita. And the writer of the Bhagavad Gita was one whose lips were kissed by the fire of the immortal. This song of the Lord is called an Upanishad. In those Upanishads cast in the form of the divine dialogue, the answer is usually ascribed to one or other person of the Trinity. Just like in the Old Testament, the messages are either from Yahweh Elohim or from one of the angels of the Lord, and so on. In the Gita, it is given by Krishna, God in His wholeness beyond human compassing, presented in man form. The account given in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad about the creation of man, manushya, people, creatures with intelligence. That's how the Upanishad talks of them. Sometimes we may well wonder, where is the intelligence, even to this day, in man? However, there it is. So, man is, in a sense, the intelligence of the divine embodied. This is where the brain and the quality of the brain has to play its part. That is why the pure life is necessary. Drink plenty of alcohol and see what happens to the brain as well as to the liver. You get not only cirrhosis of the liver, but you'll get other unpleasant things also if you drink too much, and so on. Or even if you drink a little bit, it affects the brain. So the quality of the brain becomes extremely important. And that holds not only where drink is concerned, but where food is concerned. Animal food is detrimental to the brain where the deeper states of consciousness are concerned. That is one of the reasons why the holy ones abstained from meat, from flesh food. There was a brother of Jesus who abstained altogether from meat, and he was known as the Holy One. He spent his days in praying, and he was regarded by the Jews as the bulwark against evil. It's very interesting, all this, how you find these correspondences.